headlines, Iran's parliament speaker says Tehran is determined to fully implement a recent law to increase the country's nuclear activities aimed at removing anti-Iran sanctions. U.S. President Joe Biden's administration temporarily freezes arms sales to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates for review. And also, hundreds of Rohingya are reported missing from a refugee camp in Indonesia and are believed to have been trafficked to neighboring Malaysia. Hello and welcome, everybody. Iran's parliament speaker says Tehran is determined to fully implement a recent law to increase the country's nuclear activities aimed at removing anti-Iran sanctions.
Our enemies have already realized and must know that we are determined to implement this law until we see the full removal of sanctions. Of course, this nuclear industry helps us to take our main step, which is neutralizing the sanctions.
Khadibov said the implementation of the strategic action plan is within the framework of the 2015 nuclear deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Khadibov noted that the law has left the door open for Iran's return to full compliance once other signatories fully abide by their JCPOA obligations, including the removal of all anti-Iran sanctions. The top parliamentarian made the remarks during a visit to the Fordow nuclear facility. He also criticized the other signatories to the accord for failing to live up to their commitments. And for further insight on that story, we're now joined by Mr. Barry Grossman, who's an international lawyer, joining us from Bali. Also, we have political commentator and analyst, Mr. Hamidreza Ghulamzadeh, who's joining us from Tehran. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Grossman. Sir, give us your thoughts on the recent comments made by the Iranian parliament speaker. He believes that Tehran is determined to fully implement a recent law to increase the country's nuclear activities aimed at removing anti-Iran sanctions. What does that mean?
Well, it means what I think it means, what he says it means, namely that as things stand, there's really no obstacle to Iran increasing its enrichment activities. Iran is certainly not in breach of the JCPOA, bearing in mind that it wasn't a unilateral treaty. It was a treaty with multiple signatories, each of which had obligations, and applying basic principles, since all of the other signatories, not just the United States, I might add, but the European signatories as well, have essentially breached both their obligations and their subsequent commitments in the case of European countries to find a way forward, that would seem to open the way for Iran to increase its enrichment activities, bearing in mind that unlike other nations in the region, Iran is a signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and in fact, with full disclosure, as long as there's a clear commitment not to develop nuclear weapons, Iran is not only entitled under the treaty to enriched uranium, but to receive technology transferred from other signatory countries. And instead, what we see is the United States clandestinely giving support to the Saudis and their nuclear program in violation of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. We see the U.S. spreading its nuclear armaments around the world in violation of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. We see Israel with this substantial armory of nuclear weapons developed in violation of all relevant international principles. And we see Iran denied the benefit of the JCPOA, which with heavy lobbying by Atlantic world countries led by the United States, it was essentially bullied into agreeing to. As for Iran, let's be perfectly clear about this. All of the decision makers, all of the people responsible for assessing Iran's compliance were of the same opinion, namely that Iran was in full compliance with the JCPOA. Until, of course, the other signatories completely abandoned their obligations, which in turn freed Iran up to implement these measures that we're now seeing it take now. What Iran intends to do with that increased output of enriched uranium is, of course, anyone's guess. It certainly would be free to sell that uranium to other countries that are signatories to the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Of course, the uranium can be used in all manner of non-military applications, so there's a big question there. But it seems nothing short of getting more aggressive is going to see the other signatory countries even indicate a willingness to discuss compliance with the commitments they made. And the Biden administration, for its part, has already made it very clear through the Secretary of State that it's already decided not to, to return to the JCPOA anytime soon, certainly not without a full renegotiation of the terms of that treaty, which Iran has made it perfectly clear it's not willing to do.
All right, let's cross over to Tehran with Mr. Hamidreza Ghulamzadeh. Mr. Ghulamzadeh, welcome to the program. The Iranian Parliament Speaker, during this recent statement, also criticized other signatories to the accord for failing to live up to their commitments. Why should Iran be the only one to fulfill the commitments under the JCPOA, while the other signatories have been lacking, lagging in that regard?
Actually, the law that the parliament passed about a month ago was a reaction to that, an opposition to the asymmetrical commitment, we can say, that it was only Iran being remaining committed to the deal, and the other parties just looking at it without anything, just words and saying something without doing any real things on the ground, especially about the Europeans and the INSTEX mechanism that they claim is going to be helpful after the Americans withdrew from the JCPOA. But we know so far that it has not been working at all. It was just one time, it was very low amount of money, and it was just something useless compared to the achievements that Iran was supposed to have within the JCPOA. But the point is that the imbalance is something that Iran cannot understand anymore. It's just remaining committed to that, accepting all the limitations and accepting all the extra monitoring, extra inspections from the agency is not something that can work anymore like that. So what Iran is saying and telling the other parties is that if you want to benefit from the all the things that you are supposed to have within the JCPOA, which is an observation and monitoring the nuclear activities of Iran, then you should pay the price. That's the deal. If Iran has not been benefiting from the ease of sanctions or such things, even during the President Obama, the banking transactions were not open and the sanctions remained in place, let alone that we had Americans withdraw from the JCPOA. So if the Europeans really want to actually enjoy this monitoring and inspections on the Iranian nuclear program, so the price is that they need to enforce actually Americans to remove the sanctions. It's very easy. It's a commitment to a resolution by the United Nations Security Council. It is being committed to the international law. And it is a very simple issue. It's a simple logical issue, actually, that, okay, you want to enjoy that, you want the benefits, you should pay the price. And the price now is the easiest thing that Iran could offer, was that you should satisfy and convince, actually, the Americans to remove the sanctions and get back to the JCPOA, to the deal, and compensate, the, of course, the damages that they have inflicted upon Iran as well. And on the other side, we have Biden administration now in office for about a week, and they need to prove to the world that they are going to be different from Trump administration. They are more internationalist, and they are in favor of multilateralism, such things. So that's the ground. That's the best choice for the Americans to prove that they are truly committed to internationalism and to multilateralism, as Mr. Blinken has several times mentioned that now and before the Trump administration, when he was in office during Obama administration. So that's the best choice and the best opportunity for them to remove the sanctions, to compensate the damages, and to get back to the JCPOA with a clean return, without any preconditions, to show to the world that they actually pay attention to the JCPOA.
Mr. Grossman, what are you expecting to see from the Biden administration in this regard?
Well, more of the same. In fact, I think what we have to come around to recognizing here is what we knew all along, namely that the underlying reason why the Americans and their European allies pressed Iran in the first place to negotiate the JCPOA, in fact, had nothing to do with any concern about Iran developing a nuclear military capability. It had to do with a whole lot of other things. And of course, the complaint that the previous administration had and other Democrats who were not happy with the JCPOA was that it entirely failed to address matters like nuclear's perfectly legitimate missile program, and it certainly failed to do anything to advance the U.S. commitment to yet another one of their programs of what they would call regime change. The reality is, from the beginning, going back many years, all 17 agencies making up the U.S. security apparatus agreed in their classified briefings to Congress that Iran didn't have a nuclear military program, had made no political decision to even start one or prepare to start one in the future, and that Iran would be caught out if it attempted to break out. And what we're seeing unfold here, in my opinion, is the reality that the Americans understand that, and that what they're really after has nothing to do with security from a nuclear threat so much as simply bringing the fight to Iran in order to agitate for civil unrest and make life as difficult as possible for Iranians in the hope of achieving some kind of regime change, which of course is not going to happen. Instead, what's going to happen is Iran will have to come to terms with its own political reality. And the further we go down this path, of course, the more difficult it will be politically for Iran to entertain the possibility of a full return to the JCPOA. And that seems to be something that not very many people are thinking about over there on the other side of the pond in Washington, or for that matter, in European capitals. They talked a good story about how they were going to stick with the deal, create new banking mechanisms for facilitating payments outside of the usual system that saw money channeled through the United States. But in the end, they did exactly nothing. And in that sense, the European powers, certainly the individual nations, are every bit as culpable as the Americans in the situation which has developed and which now sees many people in Iran suffering as a result of the unilateral sanctions that have been imposed by the United States on Iran and threats made by the United States against any other nation and any private, any corporation, any private individual or publicly traded corporation or private corporation which dares to do business with Iran. And in the meantime, what we've been seeing is open piracy on the seas and all the usual things that Americans like to complain about, unless, of course, it's them that are doing it.
All right. Thanks a lot, gentlemen. That was international lawyer Barry Grossman joining us from Bali. Also, thanks to political commentator and analyst Hamid Rezo Ghulamzadeh speaking to us from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Elsewhere, Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, says his trip to Georgia is aimed at helping diffuse tensions in the region with the help of regional countries. In a meeting with Georgian President Salom Zarubishvili, the top Iranian diplomat said he also seeks to boost cooperation with neighboring countries during his trip. Prior to his meeting with the Georgian president, Zarif laid a wreath at the memorial of Georgian national heroes in the capital, Tbilisi. During his talks, Zarif underlined that Iran and Georgia enjoy age-old relations and that the two sides have good potential to work together in the transportation sector. Zarif's trip to Georgia was part of his whistle-stop regional tour. The United States has temporarily frozen planned arms sales to the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia for review. A State Department spokesperson said the move is aimed at ensuring the sales meet Washington's strategic objectives with regard to its partners. The frozen deals include a $23 billion package of F-35 jets to the UAE. Former U.S. President Donald Trump's administration agreed to the deal after the UAE normalized its relations with Israel. The U.S. has also been preparing major sales of munitions to Saudi Arabia. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said in his Senate confirmation session that the Saudi onslaught on Yemen has contributed to the dire humanitarian situation in the country. Political analyst Brian Terrell says the U.S. is concerned about its own strategic objectives rather than the lives of Yemenis.
I think this is, it's a very positive change that we have a president now who understands that the COVID-19 pandemic and climate change are real things, need to be dealt with. But what we're seeing is a return to normal, and as reassuring as that might be, we need to remember how bad normal was, and that this war in Yemen began under the Obama administration when now President Biden was Vice President of the United States. I'm concerned over Secretary Blinken's saying that it's advances to our strategic objectives that this review is going to be based on, and not consideration for the people of Yemen who's are facing humanitarian disaster that Mr. Blinken is talking about as well. This is, in the United States, the big arms manufacturers like Lockheed Martin and Raytheon, they don't just follow U.S. policies, they make them.
Elsewhere, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says Washington rejects Beijing's maritime claims in the South China Sea beyond what is permitted under international law. Blinken pledged to stand with Southeast Asian claimants in the face of China's pressure. He made the remarks in a call with Philippine Foreign Minister Teodoro Loxin. China claims almost all of the energy-rich South China Sea, which is also a major trade route. The Philippines, Brunei, Vietnam, Malaysia, and Taiwan have overlapping claims. China has time and again accused the U.S. of interference and increasing tensions in the region. Independent geopolitical analyst Brian Berletic says the U.S. view about international law is hypocritical.
Most of this started under the Obama-Biden administration. It only heated up under the Trump administration, but it's going to continue now that Biden is U.S. president, because this is all being driven by a singular U.S. foreign policy to encircle and contain China, and this has been ongoing for many years, you could even say decades, and this latest leg of it is also going to absolutely continue under Biden. And as a matter of fact, everything that we hear the now new U.S. Secretary of State saying about the South China Sea is just an echo of Mike Pompeo from the last 4 years about, you know, China overstepping its bounds and the U.S. backing Southeast Asian countries. It's also very difficult for nations here in the region, again, including nations the U.S. claims it's champion for. It's very difficult for them to take the U.S.'s involvement seriously and see it as sincere assistance and not just a pretext for the U.S. to maintain what it itself calls in all of its policy papers its desire to establish primacy over Asia. The United States is not an Asian nation, so why is it seeking primacy in Asia? This is very problematic, and of course it's very hypocritical when we're talking about international law and even international norms.
Hundreds of Rohingya have reportedly disappeared from a refugee camp in northern Indonesia. Local officials in the city of Lhokseumawe say only 112 refugees from nearly 400 have remained at the makeshift camp. Indonesian authorities and the UN say they do not know the whereabouts of the missing refugees, adding that they might have been trafficked to neighboring Malaysia. The refugees that arrived in Indonesia last year, members of the stateless minority group, have long faced discrimination in Myanmar. They've been denied freedom of movement and citizenship and lack access to work, health care, and schools. Nearly a million of them crossed into neighboring Bangladesh after Myanmar's military launched a brutal crackdown. In 2017, the UN has described the plight of Rohingya as a textbook example of ethnic cleansing. And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Two Blue Lines, directed by Tom Hayes. And joining me in the studio, we have Mike McCahill, who is a film and television critic for The Guardian and The Telegraph. And beside him, we are also joined by Professor Jonathan Rosenhead from the London School of Economics. He is also vice chair of Free Speech on Israel, a non-Zionist Jewish organization that believes anti-Zionism is not anti-Semitism. Now, filmed over 25 years, Two Blue Lines explores the impact of Israeli settlement on the Palestinians from before the creation of Israel to the present day, and not afraid to explore correlations between the Holocaust and Israel's treatment of Palestine, what emerges is a picture of a desperate social and political struggle punctuated by violence, segregation, and racism. By primarily featuring the narratives of Israelis whose positions run counter to Israel's official policy, this documentary also provides a portrait of the ongoing conflict not often depicted in the mainstream media.
You cannot come into an area where other people are living, establish a state, confiscate their lands, and expect to live in safety. And that's what happened. They came and conquered and confiscated.
In these camps of misery live the scores of thousands whose native land was for centuries Palestine.
We took land that in the Bible maybe is ours, but it definitely wasn't empty. There are people living here. This is their land.
Every sense of the word.
From a distance, this Jewish colony in Palestine looks as romantic as a Dutch picture. Close to, it's different. The guards are Jewish colonists armed with shotguns.
This is not fair. So remember where you come from. Wait.
It's immoral what they do with religion, to my mind. And it's not Jewish. It's un-Jewish.
This is the acid test. This is the reality test. All these values that we've held for all these generations.
If people in the U.S. would be treated like this, we would blow up the planet.
There is a way leading from humanity through nationality to bestiality.
3 a.m. and the killing is going on. Imagine. United States paying for all this.
First of all, a very warm welcome to you. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, this documentary tackles a controversial subject and isn't shy to portray Israel in a negative light, and even interviews Israelis themselves who are against Israel's policies against the Palestinians and their treatment. Mike, if I can start with you, what was your take on this documentary?
I think it's a little bit patchwork and piecemeal, and that's in part because of the way that this film was produced over the course of 25 years. So there is a sense of a director sort of going back to material and just stitching it together where he can. I think it has moments of real power, and as you say, it does have this new perspective on these events, and I think one of the challenges this conflict has presented to filmmakers is to try and find fresh angles, fresh ways into the conflict that aren't just restating the same old positions time and time and again. And this does find two or three new angles into this conflict that I thought were particularly revealing.
And what are some of those angles that you mentioned?
Well, I mean, getting Israelis to talk about this conflict, and particularly recruiting very calmly spoken, very sympathetic Israelis who have been given, at the very least, cause to doubt what their rulers have been doing over the past 50 years in particular, and often are openly critical of official state policy. it is obviously a very, very tricky subject, but here there is a sense of filmmaker really going a little bit deeper and finding out there are little pockets of room to maneuver, room for negotiation.
It is refreshing to see.
Yeah, very much so.
And Jonathan, if I can turn to you, what was your take on this documentary?
Well, it's very much not a neutral film. It is objective in that it describes quite calmly some very disturbing things. It represents, perhaps not quite proportionally, it represents the views of some of the settlers who are, if you like, the beneficiaries and the perpetrators of many of the wrongs. It does so in order to reveal the inconsistencies in their position and their assumptions, and some of which I think do at the time is extremely repugnant. But so that when one of the settlers says, oh, there's violence on both sides, I was shot at once, I was shot at in my car with a machine gun, and then he's asked later on, why do you live with your children in this dangerous area? He said, oh, it only happened to once. But for Palestinians, it happens every day, not that they're being shot at, but they are subjugated, humiliated, prevented from going about their daily life, etc. And that is shown very vividly.
We do indeed get a spectrum of opinion and views on this documentary.
The whole world sees the immorality of our situation, of what we're doing, and of what we've been doing since we've been occupying the West Bank for 22 years. For two decades, the world didn't see it because the Palestinians seemed willing to live under Israeli rule. That is, they didn't revolt. The children who grew up in that period, seeing their parents bending their heads under Israeli occupation, said to themselves, when I grow up, I'm not going to put up with this. And so began the Intifada.
But I just want to address a point he made. Jonathan, he says that the Palestinians seemed willing, or the older generation, to live under Israeli rule. Surely that can't be right.
I was in Israel in 1956 as a visitor. I visited it not at all for the next 40 years. I don't know, I can't say from first hand what it was, but one can imagine the trauma of this total dispossession. 80% of the Palestinians were forced out. Those that were left often had their villages and their homes destroyed. So one can well imagine that it took time to recover from that. And I think the younger generation, which grew up under those circumstances, was then more resilient and said, we don't want to live like this for the rest of our lives. Now, of course, the fact is they have had to live like that for the rest of their lives, and it's getting worse.
And definitely in this film you see this resurgence and this uprising, especially among the youth. And Mike, do you have any thoughts on what Jonathan just said and how the portrayal of the resistance is shown?
Yeah, I mean, certainly one of the advantages this film has is that it is shot over 25 years, so you do get a sense of not just how long this conflict is going on, but how positions are shifting, how people's perspectives are changing in the course of that quarter century. I do think you get a sense that people are becoming more and more aware that actually for a long time the only way out of this conflict has been death. And I think people are starting to look for avenues, ways out, communicate their position in a way that isn't necessarily violent, and all that comes through in the course of the film.
Of course, in the documentary you also see lots of statistics filmed over 25 years, many historical events that happened during that time. And I just want to touch on a few statistics that the documentary raises, particularly about Palestinian children fatalities in comparison to Israeli casualties. And you can see the difference is stark. So according to the documentary, child fatalities between 2000 and 2014 of Israeli children was something like 133, whereas over 1,400 Palestinian kids were killed by the Israeli side. Does this show then that this is indeed an unequal war?
It's not really a war at all, because it's not a war. A war, you have to have two sides. Here you have basically one side, which can punish the other side at will. Now, I think the suicide bombing was both immoral and it was counterproductive for the Palestinians, so I'm not trying to defend that. But it was a relatively short period when it was realized it was actually reinforcing the tendencies to repression of the Israeli state, so that was cancelled, and I think that is completely right. But people in this country pay attention when Israel is attacking Gaza, and they quite a lot of people would know that 2,000 people were killed, more than 2,000 were killed in the last assault in 2014. What they don't realize is that this happens on a small but regular scale every day of the week, and that the numbers killed of Palestinians now in excess of 10,000, so that the assaults on Gaza are less than half of the total of deaths, and that is the price of Israel repressing the Palestinians.
And Mike, do you think that this documentary then portrays the conflict as an unequal one, an unequal conflict, and serves as a good introduction to people who are unaware of what is happening?
Yes, certainly. It is talking to people on the ground. It is talking to people, you know, who are caught up in this conflict, either on one side or the other. So it shows you the way the travel system has been converted in a particular way, so that Israelis are allowed to travel on certain roads, Palestinians aren't. Certain roads are blocked off, walled off. The level of control extends to something like the water supply, and there's a lot of talk in this film about, you know, some people are going without water, other people have enough water to fill a swimming pool.
The settlements have some, yes.
Yeah, exactly. And so what you get in the course of the film is a sense of the level of control that's being imposed over every single aspect of life. And you know, to see that is very stark.
It is far-reaching and multifaceted.
The minimum service that the municipality have to give to the people is to take the garbage, to collect the garbage. I don't talk about the roads. You can see the road. I don't talk about lights. I don't talk about school services and water services. Even water, people, the municipality didn't give them. The municipality said,
No bees at all. There is no bees at all.
This is all done on purpose. Nothing of the occupation happens by chance. No. It happens on purpose. It happens in order to make the Palestinians' life a hell.
We have dehumanized the enemy, as we have been dehumanized only a short time ago. We call them chayadu'aglut, a two-legged animal. We are reenacting without being able to control it. We are reenacting what happened to us as if we've never learned anything.
Very powerful words there. Jonathan, I just wanted to get a quick reaction from you following from that clip of that woman, what she just said, and drawing comparisons between the Holocaust and Israel's treatment of Palestine.
Yeah, so that in Britain, where we're speaking from, has become a big issue because there's been an attempt to police what you're allowed to say about Israel or Palestine. If you make any such comparison, there will be a whole gang of people on the phone to the papers or the government saying that this is anti-Semitism because you're drawing parallels. But of course we have to draw parallels with those events in history which speak to people. That's our way of making sense of what's happening now. It's not to say that it is the same, it's different, its scale is completely different. The intention is not to annihilate a whole race, but the intention is to demolish a nation, which is slightly different with all its identifying characteristics, and to steal its land. And one has to be able to make those parallels, just as one makes the parallels with South African apartheid, which is, I think, in this documentary, absolutely starkly evident that it's apartheid in Israel.
And Mike, we were just talking before we went to the clip, actually, about how this documentary portrays how Palestinians are being dehumanized in every aspect of this control system. What other scenes from the film struck out the most to you?
Well, I mean, one of the things this film did was introduce me to a number of the groups who are working within the Middle East to try and resolve this conflict peacefully. So, you know, groups like Blockade Watch and Peace Block, the Women in Black, who are, I think, wives and mothers and daughters who are on the Israeli side, who come out to mourn the losses of you know, all the children killed in the conflict. So there is a sense of people on the ground starting to realize the extent to which this conflict has cost them personally. And, you know, the scenes of mourning are very, very powerful.
And speaking of Israeli settlements, this documentary goes into detail about that and interviews settlers themselves, who we can see are quite vicious in their treatment to the Palestinians. Now, according to reports, around 600,000 Israelis live in over 230 illegal settlements built since the 1967 Israeli occupation of Palestinian territories of the West Bank and East Jerusalem al-Quds, which is in violation of international law and the United Nations Security Council resolutions. And this documentary does a good job of showing various UN resolutions that are being violated. Why then is the UN so powerless against Israel?
Oh, well, that's very clear. The UN is unable to pass resolutions which would have teeth, that is to say, which would impose sanctions on Israel without the agreement of all the powers with vetoes at the Security Council. And the United States has vetoed over 40 such resolutions over time. Often it's been the only country in the Security Council voting against a resolution. So it ensures that the so-called international community is absolutely toothless. And countries like Britain or the European Union regularly pass resolutions in Parliament saying we deplore this, we don't like that. They do nothing because they are unwilling to separate themselves from this very strong United States position. So the whole international community mouths pious words, except perhaps the United States doesn't do it so much, and does nothing. And therefore it's up to the Palestinians themselves who have to endure, and the international civic society which has to adopt boycott, divestment and sanctions. Well, boycott is what we can do as individuals, as a means of supporting and putting pressure on the Israelis to come to the table and make the concessions necessary for peace.
This village cannot have electricity. You'll see there are electric wires that an NGO put in, but the Israeli military will not allow them to hook up to the electric grid. If you can imagine that kind of racism. I believe if people in the U.S. would be treated like this, we would blow up the planet. You know, I've seen the most heinous crimes committed against Palestinians, and my Israeli friends would stand with me in saying the same thing.
The fact that there are Americans who are tolerating in Israel what they would not tolerate in the United States itself, and American Jews who accept that Israel behave in a way which they would very much object to people behave in the United States itself, is very bad for Israel.
And Mike, what did you make of this part of the documentary? Was this another refreshing angle to see on this conflict?
Certainly. I mean, it's telling that actually the production company responsible is called Journeyman Films. You can see that this is the work of an American director, a veteran American director. Probably wasn't quite as veteran when he first started shooting all this than when he came out of it. But it is, I think, clearly the work of an American director possessed of a conscience enough to want to bring this conflict back home to America and to show the American people exactly what's going on in this particular part of the world. And it does a very good job of defining this very complex relationship between the US and Israel as we go into the final half hour of the film.
And Jonathan, this film confronts American viewers with a sort of Israeli schism over the country's oppression of Palestine, as well as the US government's responsibility. The documentary says that over $100 billion of taxpayers' money have been spent to Israel, the most than any other country in the world. And the majority of the Security Council vetoes have supported Israel's wars. Do you think this documentary will serve as a wake-up call then to Western audiences?
But that very much depends on how widely it gets viewed. And there is a very elaborate and expensive and effective campaign run by the Ministry of Strategic Affairs in Israel to try and blanket the world with propaganda favorable to Israel. And we have, of course, our own domestic in Britain, Israel Lobby, which was shown in a recent documentary. We have the very powerful Israel Lobby in the United States. And the media is very nearly impermeable to these sorts of arguments generally. And that the campaign to persuade people that even relatively mild criticism of Israel is probably motivated by anti-Semitism started in Israel and has been pumped out around the world. And I think the reason is they don't want this message to get out. Now, whether this documentary can make it, I very much hope so. And if so, it will have a powerful effect.
Excellent.
actually a point you just made. The documentary mentions about the media and how these Israelis are always portrayed as the victims, whereas the Palestinians are the aggressors, when actually it's the reverse situation.
Yes.
How responsible does the media, what role do they play in pushing this narrative?
Well, I think they are susceptible to it. And there is a battle going on about language, how you describe things. It's, as Alice said in Alice in Wonderland, it's when Alice says to Humpty Dumpty, you can't use that word, make it mean anything you like, and Humpty Dumpty says, the question is who's to be master, that's all. And if you can control the language by which something is described, you control the perceptions. And I think that attempt is going on. We have to fight for the right to describe it as it is.
And Mike, would you agree with what Jonathan said? Do you think this documentary will serve as a wake-up call also for Western audiences?
Well, hopefully. I mean, you know, it's getting a pretty small distribution. It's being independently distributed online. It doesn't have necessarily the cinematic heft that we've seen films like Waltz with Bashir and The Gatekeepers, the documentary from a couple of years back, that were all about Israeli people talking about the failings of the Israeli authorities. So it doesn't quite have that cinematic heft. But, you know, if you can find it out, like I say, it does have some really powerful moments.
And if I could just, we're coming to the end of the programme now, if I could get your final thoughts on the documentary and if you'd recommend it.
Oh, it's certainly, you know, this situation is so tricky, but, you know, any new perspective that people can find on it, it, you know, it is worth seeking out for that reason.
And Jonathan, can I get your final thoughts on the film also?
Very striking how little has changed, except insofar it's intensified and got worse. You see the interviews and you're not sure necessarily whether it was done in 1989, 1999, 2009. This is a continuing story, and we have failed, and we have to do better.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. I'm afraid we've run out of time on Doc Review. And that's it for this episode of the show. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camelia Shambayati, and see you on the next episode of Doc Review.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of Al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam Al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام لما سئل وكيف لا يسأل عما يفعل لأنه لا يفعل إلا ما كان حكمة وصوابا.
Imam al-Baqir عليه السلام was once asked why it is that Allah cannot be questioned about what he does. To which he replied, because he only does what is wise and good.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Dear friends, when talking about amazing dialogues and golden conversations, we find that there is truly a very golden and beautiful conversation that can be found in the historical text between a student and a teacher, between a disciple and a master. Now, this conversation takes place between a knowledgeable student and a companion by the name of Jabir al-Jufi and the master, the Imam, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam. In this very beautiful conversation, we find that Imam al-Baqir, peace and blessings upon him, tells some immortal and exemplary moral standards, ethical values, and amazing ideals to Jabir al-Jufi. The conversation itself is quite long, and there are so many different and profound things which Imam al-Baqir says, but we have decided to just pick some from amongst these statements. Now, one of the things that Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam says in this conversation to Jabir al-Jufi is that there is no virtue like jihad, and there is no jihad like striving against caprice, against fancies and whims and vain indulgences. In a day and age where people like to throw the word jihad around left and right, it is very interesting that one of the ways in which Imam al-Baqir defines jihad is that jihad, struggle, fighting, standing up to, is a great virtue. And then he defines this standing up, this fighting, this struggling, this jihad, this struggle, as being the one where one strives against vain indulgences and whims and fancies and these selfish desires. And truly, dear friends, fighting against one's whims and vain indulgences and fancies is a great struggle. It is a great jihad. Because in reality, we are all fighting ourselves. Beautiful words exchanged in this dialogue between Jabir al-Jufi and Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. I am Atta, the host of the program Dialogue. Now, this moment, I invite you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Ayyub Rashid. I hope you enjoy this part and stay tuned till the end of today's program.
After a long period, if you can imagine from 61, the Shahad of Imam Abi Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salam, until 95, for the period of 34 years, it was not easy for Shias to spread their knowledge easily because Bani Umayyah were after them. As per one narration, just one, it says that the scholars of Ahlul Bayt or those who were befriending Ahlul Bayt, whenever they were talking about hadith of Amirul Mu'mineen, It has been narrated from this person, from that, from Amirul Mu'mineen. They, because of the terror which was there, they used not to mention the name of Ali. They would never say it has been narrated from Ali bin Abi Talib. They used to say it has been narrated from a sheikh. Qala sheikh. Sheikh has said. This hadith is from sheikh. So it was a way people, followers of Ahlul Bayt, knew that this sheikh is Ali bin Abi Talib. Can you imagine? Look at that time and our time. It was so difficult until the time of Al-Baqir and later on As-Sadiq alayhim as-salam, they managed to teach openly. The period of Al-Baqir, it was the period of Shia identity. After Karbala, now Shias are ready to identify themselves as Shias openly. It was the time of teaching of the lessons from Al-Muhammad. So you can say it has been narrated from As-Sajjad, from Al-Hussein, from Al-Hassan, from Ali, easily. It was the period of open majalis. Majlis after Karbala, there was no any majlis. But this time of Al-Baqir, it was now the time people could attend majalis openly and they could rediscuss anything easily. It was a time when Imam alayhi salam taught his students to be able to give fatwa, especially to the people who were far away from Medina. So this period, when we look closely, we find that Imam alayhi salam and later on his son, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, they managed to do, according to historians, they say number one, at-ta'alim. Ta'alim in the sense that Imam alayhi salam managed to create a group of educated Shias, and he himself used to take care of them to educate them properly. And he trained capable scholars. They could go wherever and teach easily. Also, he trained narrators of ahadith. If you remember, when Imam Sahib al-Asri wa Zaman, Ajjalallahu Farajahu Sharif, when he was going for occultation, the major occultation, when people wanted to know how are we going to get our knowledge from and from who, he said, refer to the ruwat of hadithina. Refer to the narrators of our hadith, because they refer from us and we depend on them in terms of teaching.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
You heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.